Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Today is Monday, November 7th. Amanda Borchel-Dan here with our editor, David Horowitz, and news editor, Amy Spiro. Hello to you both.
Hey, Amanda.
Good morning.
We will start off by hearing about some inflammatory remarks made by far-right leader Bezalel Smotrich and how it's all up to incoming Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to rein in his coalition. In the second half of the program, Amy will tell us about an overlooked chapter of Holocaust history. But first, we'll hear a word from our sponsor.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you care about the war in Israel right now. And you've been reading the headlines. Massacre in Gaza. Genocide perpetrated by Hamas. No, by Israel. But if you've been listening to this podcast long enough, you know one thing. This stuff seems complicated. And honestly, no one can really just pick a side or decide an opinion without really learning, without really knowing what you're talking about. And that's where this podcast comes in. Check out Unpacking Israeli History, now in its sixth season. They have episodes with topics ranging from what is Hamas anyway, to whether Israel should ransom captured soldiers, and the history of Israel and its disengagement from Gaza in 2005. Unpacking Israeli History cuts through the noise and helps you understand Israel's present through understanding Israel's history. So, educate yourself. Learn the history behind the headlines. Find Unpacking Israeli History wherever you listen to your podcasts.
And we're back. David, yesterday we got a little taste of the incoming coalition when religious Zionist leader Bezalel Smotrich spoke during the official memorial ceremony at the Knesset, marking 27 years since Rabin's assassination. And he asserted that essentially some of the blame for Rabin's murder lay with Israel's Shin Bet security service. So what exactly was Smotrich asserting?
Well, this is complicated, and I'm going to try carefully to present this accurately. Smotrich, at the Knesset ceremony marking 27 years since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin by the extremist right-winger Yigal Amir, alleged that the Shin Bet had failed. The responsibility for the assassination lay with the Shin Bet, which had failed in its task of protecting the prime minister. And he further alleged that religious Zionists, rabbis and so on, he didn't specify, but religious Zionists were not to blame for the murder. It was not their fault. It was nothing to do with them. And he alleged that, in fact, the Shin Bet had encouraged the murder by various manipulations which were being hidden from the public. So to first of all explain why that has caused such a storm, the Shin Bet would acknowledge, and in fact issued statements by unnamed sources, it did fail. It did fail to protect Rabin from the assassin. Yigal Amir killed Yitzhak Rabin at the end of a rally, and the security service failed to intercept him. The Shin Bet and accepted narrative, which Yigal Amir confirmed under investigation, was that he did act alone, but drew support from rabbis and others in the religious Zionist community who he felt encouraged him. He felt that he was encouraged by that climate in that community, people in that community. And that, so that part of the allegation is being roundly condemned by the Shin Bet. And further, the notion that the Shin Bet had somehow encouraged the murder, this touches on, and we've got this on the site, so you can read about this more carefully, a Shin Bet agent, codenamed Champagne, who apparently had come across the idea that Yigal Amir was talking about or considering killing the prime minister. That's obviously what Smotrich is referring to. In closed testimony for the commission that investigated the assassination, it is apparently stated that this agent did not take that talk seriously, did not believe that Yigal Amir was going to do it. So if you break this down into those three things, yes, the Shin Bet failed to protect the prime minister. It argues vehemently that there was encouragement from the religious Zionist community, including rabbis in that community. It bitterly rejects the allegation that it in any way encouraged the assassination. And the response to Smotrich, you know, has highlighted those aspects, including, I think, notably worth saying, from Avi Dichter, who is a Likud Knesset member and a former head of the Shin Bet, who was outraged by what Smotrich had to say. I was just listening on the radio shortly before I came into the office this morning, the first Shin Bet investigator to meet with Amir after the assassination, who reaffirmed Amir acted alone with the direct assistance of his brother and a third individual, that he was extremely pleased with what he had done, and outrage on the part of this agent that both the outgoing Prime Minister, Yair Lapid, and the incoming Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, have not stridently condemned Smotrich for distorting what unfolded.
Okay, Netanyahu didn't condemn, perhaps, the remarks, but at the same commemoration, he struck a more conciliatory tone than we've heard in the past. Do you see this as foretelling his position in leading his new coalition?
Look, it is the habit of all successful politicians after nasty, bitter election campaigns, once the result is in, for the victor to switch to a more magnanimous tone. And I am not surprised that we're hearing a more magnanimous tone from Netanyahu. The proof of the pudding will be how he actually governs the country, given that there are agendas, his own, by the way, and those of his coalition partners that are extremely problematic for democratic governance of Israel. So it's nice that he sounded a little gentler and spoke about the need to get out of the trenches now and unify. But you know, let's see what the actions are.
We've been trying to parse out the vote, and we've heard that many who voted for religious Zionists have claimed that they did so as a quote-unquote security vote. But what kind of military service did Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir complete, actually? Tell us.
Well, Smotrich did a fairly brief term of service, and Ben-Gvir did no service at all. He was not drafted by the IDF because they were too concerned about having someone in their ranks who had been as extreme in acts and words as he had, even as a teenager. And therefore, you're asking me that. So, you know, why are you asking me that? Because of the likelihood at this stage that Itamar Ben-Gvir will be placed as the Minister of Public Security. It's not confirmed, in which case he'll be in charge of the police, whose chief blamed him, among others, for fanning the flames of internal friction during the deadly violence in some Israeli mixed cities a year and a half ago. And Smotrich, scarcely believable, I would say, is being touted as a potential Minister of Defense. I want to believe that there is no prospect whatsoever of that coming to pass. But I think the military service or lack thereof of either of these two individuals is you know, somewhat problematic, though it is, in terms of the jobs that they're being connected to, is not the biggest problem. It's their approaches, it's their record, it's their declared agendas that should concern us if these two are elevated to significant positions.
Now, in the normal course of politics, it seems there are often pendulum swings, right? We had President Trump, and now we have President Biden. And we've just gone from the most diverse coalition to the most hardline. Is it just a natural yin-yang, do you think, or is there something deeper behind this?
Well, I think there are demographic shifts in Israel, and I think that that part of the political spectrum, or the Israeli tribes that helped re-elect or return Netanyahu to power last week, is growing. The election was much closer than the result shows. You know, people with electoral systems in the United States and the United Kingdom, for example, will not have too much trouble understanding this. The popular vote is not always directly reflected in the outcome. And in this case, the popular vote was very, very close to 50-50. And yet Netanyahu has a 64-seat coalition in a 120-member Knesset. So that's an 8-seat majority. And the 56 on the other side don't all like each other, to put it mildly, whereas his 64 are pretty unified. He was aided by a very effective campaign, by the rise of the charismatic and dangerous Itamar Ben-Gvir, and by incredible complacency and worse among those who oppose him. The Arab Party split that actually may have drawn more Arab voters to the polling stations, but one of the parties fell below the threshold and wasted 130,000 plus votes, the equivalent, depending on how you calculate it, of perhaps three seats. And Meretz and Labour famously did not merge, and Meretz slipped below the threshold, even closer to the threshold, with 150,000 plus votes, and therefore sent another 3 to 4 seats to waste. Now, you can't say that, oh, otherwise it would have been 60-60 or something. You can't know how people would have voted if they were given different opportunities. But they made Netanyahu's path to a coalition easier. They enlarged his majority.
Okay, David, thank you for this. And obviously, we will continue to parse out the election results in the coming days and weeks. Let's go to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. Amy, you recently interviewed British journalist Simon Parkin, the author of The Island of Extraordinary Captives, which illustrates the lives of thousands of Jewish refugees who were held in Hutchinson Camp on the Isle of Man after fleeing Nazi Germany. First of all, tell us, where is the Isle of Man on the map, just so we can place it?
Sure. So the Isle of Man is basically sort of right between England and Ireland.
Okay, so why were these Jews arrested, essentially detained?
So basically what happened is that, you know, in 1938, 39, a lot of Jews were fleeing Germany and they ended up in the UK. A lot of them had help from the UK. People came on the Kinder transport, obviously, most famously. And a lot of other German Jews were obviously looking for somewhere to go, and the UK felt like a safe place. And then when the war started, you know, there was such a panic in the UK, and they sort of felt like Germany was about to invade. And one thing that the government decided to do is to basically round up enemy aliens and round up people they were feared would be sympathetic to the German cause. And the vast majority of German people who were in the UK at the time were, in fact, Jews and were refugees who'd come and fled because they feared Nazi Germany. And that's mostly who ended up arrested. So Hutchinson Camp was one of a few camps on the Isle of Man. There were also some other similar camps not on the Isle of Man, but basically the estimated figure is about 80% of the people that the UK arrested at that time were in fact Jewish.
Now, we have all heard, obviously, of the Kinder transport heroic tale. And how does this jibe with that at all?
So, yeah, it doesn't. It's sort of wild to think about the fact that about 10,000 children came on the Kinder transport. My grandmother and her two sisters were among them, and they came to the UK. And then basically 2 years later, the British government turned around and said, basically anyone over 16 was eligible to be arrested and put in these camps. They didn't take anyone under 16. And that meant that hundreds, if not thousands, of the people who were rounded up were actually teenagers who'd come on the Kinder transport, and the British government, in this sort of panic over the idea that there's the enemy living among us, rounded up people who had just, they'd helped escape.
Now, it should be made clear that it wasn't a jail per se, that there was more of a camp kind of feel, but obviously nobody could leave. But among this camp field, there was actually a camp newspaper, right? And you brought in some clippings. You already talked about your family connection. So you brought in some clippings from one of your family members.
I did. So, yeah, listen, it's hard for me to sort of say it was more of a camp than a prison, because the fact is that they were arrested and they were detained and they weren't able to be with their families and they were put behind barbed wire and they couldn't leave. So I think there's been sort of like an effort to sort of make it seem, you know, we use the word internment camp, but the word concentration camp would actually apply under the definition of the term concentration camp. So I'm not here to say it was a fun time, but I will say that one of the things the book talks about the most, and one of the things that's so sort of interesting about it, is that they did create an atmosphere for themselves where they had lectures and sporting events and concerts and even art shows. And one of the things they did was also make this newsletter. So I had several family members who were in Hutchinson camp. And one of them was my great-grandfather, who was a congregational rabbi for many years beforehand. He was arrested on Kristallnacht, sent to a concentration camp, managed to escape, and then came to the UK, then was arrested again and sent to Hutchinson camp. And he was one of a few rabbis there, and he was instrumental in getting a Sefer Torah, a Torah scroll, for those who were in the camp. And so this they called the newsletter The Camp, not super super original, but in the newsletter I can see, and it's all online, and this sort of very interesting archival history. And I can see what he wrote in the newsletter celebrating the arrival of the Torah scroll, calling on people in the camp to come and use it and pray and sort of cling to that piece of happiness in their own sort of despair at being separated from their families.
David, had you ever heard of the story growing up?
Oh, yes, because my uncle was jailed as an enemy intern in one such camp on the Isle of Man. And the only reason my father wasn't was because he was a little younger than his brother, who was. So they're the classic story that Amy described. They fled Nazi Germany in 1937. They were beginning to, you know, build their new lives in England. And then came the war. And those over, you know, Amy says the age of 16. So I was doing the maths in my head there. And I can understand exactly how that would have played out, that my dad was not sent off and his slightly older brother was. I can only imagine that in their hearts, I want to believe this, and I think it's probably true, they knew that they were in a relatively safe place. They would have understood some of the sort of geopolitical forces that were at play. And, you know, the fact that that my uncle, for example, would have known that most of his family was free and safe in England while he was being, you know, let's be nice and say protectively jailed, you know, that would have been at least a slightly more encouraging environment than would otherwise be the case. But what a terrible story, right? You fled people who are trying to mass murdering your people, and you think you're safe, and then you get locked away again. So at least I hope the context, you know, looking back for them, you know, that they would have known, please God, it's going to be all right, kind of thing.
It's interesting what you said about them sort of feeling somewhat safe, like two points. One is that a lot of them were scared that Germany was about to invade essentially the Isle of Man, right? They're right in the, you know, they're sort of an easy target. And they would think, okay, well, like, you know, I think there was a quote where I said, you know, the UK would think like, the Germans would think like, oh, the UK did our job for us. Like they've rounded up the Jews for us and put them in a camp. But on the other hand, what you're saying is, I think, you know, I discussed this with Simon, one of the reasons that the Jewish community sort of hasn't called for some sort of apology or reparations or anything like that, and the government has never really said, sorry, we did this, is because that a lot of the German Jews who were in the camps and then made their lives in the UK realized after the war that, you know, they were lucky. And so, you know, even if they were angry at the UK for what it did, they were saved from the Holocaust, right? They had, most of them almost definitely had relatives who were murdered in Germany. And therefore, they sort of said, okay, well, it was sort of a small price to pay, even if it wasn't acceptable and it wasn't okay and it wasn't anything like that. They just sort of got on with their lives.
Yeah, it's a good point. And your first point's a very good point as well. You think of what happened in places like Rhodes, where, you know, yeah, pop over from the nearest mainland and round up and send off those Jews, which is exactly what they did to the Jews of Rhodes, for example.
Yeah, they were very concerned, some of them, that they would be just an easy target.
Sure.
Amy, David, thank you for bringing this story and sharing your thoughts. And thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thank you.